I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the UN says the Syria situation is deteriorating rapidly. Tunisia grapples with a political crisis. Concern about the possible rise of civilian militias in Egypt.
The attack and the burning of a police club in a very wealthy neighborhood in Cairo on Saturday made clear that these disturbances can happen anywhere and that even the police can't protect their own property.
And Pakistan and Iran are inaugurating a controversial gas pipeline. It's all ahead. United Nations human rights investigators warn that Syria is sliding into an increasingly destructive civil war, which could have serious regional implications. In their latest report to the UN Human Rights Council, investigators say civilians are bearing the brunt of the two-year-old conflict. Lisa Schlein reports from the UN Council in Geneva.
The UN Fact-Finding Commission blasts both Syrian government forces and rebel groups for failing to protect civilians. Commission Chairman Paulo Pinheiro says the increased militarization of the conflict is having devastating consequences for civilians.
As states look for solutions to the conflict, they must bear in mind that transfers of conventional arms and ammunition should not occur when there is a clear risk that the arms will be used to commit serious violations of international humanitarian law. Under the Geneva Conventions, states that engage with the parties to the conflict have their own obligation to ensure respect for the laws of armed conflict.
The investigators said fighting in Syria has escalated since July, with the conflict becoming more sectarian, radicalized, and militarized. They said abuses by rebels are not on the same scale as those by government troops, but that both sides have used child fighters. Investigator Pinheiro says there is an urgent need for a sustained diplomatic initiative to put an end to the violence.
The war displays all the signs of a destructive stalemate. Neither party seems able to prevail over the other militarily. The result has been an escalation in the use of force, in the fallacious belief that victory is within reach.
Syria again refused access to the UN investigators. The report is based on 191 interviews conducted in February, largely in neighboring countries. Syrian ambassador Faisal Kabas Hamoui questioned the reliability and truthfulness of the witnesses interviewed by the investigators. Speaking through an interpreter, Hamoui says the report is based on wrongful information.
Syria has given the Commission very many opportunities to show that it is objective in its work and to amend its errors before cooperating with it. However, the Commission has not availed itself of this opportunity. We believe that many of the facts in this report lack credibility.
The report also calls on the international community to curb the supply of weapons going into Syria with consideration for how the arms might affect the wider region. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Moscow today met with Syrian opposition leaders who are not part of the main opposition Syrian National Coalition. He said the situation in Syria is not getting any better, and he stressed his nation's position that any solution to the Syrian crisis must come from within Syria.
The most important thing is to ensure that all questions are resolved by the Syrians themselves without insisting on any suggestions from outside, so that Syrians themselves would define both the fate of their country and the fate of specific politicians.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov through translation. Stephen Heidemann, the senior advisor for Middle East initiatives at the U.S. Institute of Peace, is a key facilitator of the Day After project, which brings together a broad spectrum of the Syrian opposition to prepare for a post-Assad regime. He discussed the opposition's future with VOA's Pam Dawkins.
Steve, what do you think of the Syrian opposition's efforts to form its own government and elect a prime minister?
I understand the impulse of the opposition to move in that direction. I think they feel that their efforts have been hampered by the lack of recognition, by the lack of support that they've received, because they do not have the character of an interim government. They haven't followed the Libyan model of creating a transitional national council that would be recognized internationally, that would receive diplomats from governments around the world, and that would be able to function as a government. On the other hand, it's a move that carries enormous risks, because if the opposition does establish itself as an interim transitional government and cannot deliver, cannot provide people with help that they need, cannot respond to concerns of Syrians who are confronting the violence of the regime, and does not secure the resources from the international community to operate effectively, it could lose credibility, it could further damage the reputation of the external opposition, and it could end up backfiring in very serious ways. And that's why there's been something of a debate within the international community about whether to encourage the opposition to move in this direction or not. The U.S., in fact, has cautioned the opposition to think carefully before they take the step of forming a transitional government. I think the opposition itself feels that it now needs to take that step, but it's aware of the risks, and I think it's taking something of a gamble.
And to follow up, you mentioned the Libyan model. Why do you think it is that the Syrian effort has been less organized, less cohesive in terms of forming a government that could, an opposition government that could gain that international support?
That's a very complicated question. How long an answer do you want? I think there are a number of factors involved. The Syrian conflict has played out under very different international circumstances than did the Libyan conflict, where you had a direct NATO presence on the ground supporting the opposition and supporting the emergent institutions of the opposition. In addition, you have a country, Syria, which is coming out of a period of 50 years of dictatorship, a period in which political life was completely suppressed by the government of Bashar al-Assad and his father before him. And so you have a group of Syrian activists, opposition activists, who really were amateurs when this process began, who didn't have the kind of experience leading political movements or creating political institutions that might have made this task somewhat easier. You also have now, for the first time, among the opposition, the opportunity for groups to speak out for themselves and to define for themselves what their own visions of the future are. And inevitably, that has led to a certain amount of friction and tension among members of the opposition as they've struggled to find common ground among themselves. And so I think we have to take account of a variety of factors when we look at the challenges that the opposition has confronted. What I've been pleased to see, though, is that even though no one would have wanted the conflict to last for as long as it has in Syria, the extended time frame of this uprising has given the opposition the chance to learn, to benefit from all of the work that it's done. And I think we are seeing the effects of that in the way the national coalition is coming together in the period since it was created last November.
Stephen Heidelman, the Senior Advisor for Middle East Initiatives at the U.S. Institute of Peace and a key facilitator of the Day After Project, speaking on Press Conference USA with Pam Dawkins and Carol Castiel. U.N. High Commissioner for Refugees Antonio Guterres says the flood of Syrians fleeing the country's civil war has intensified rapidly in recent months, rising from 3,000 a day in December to 8,000 a day last month.
This shows you the staggering escalation that we are witnessing. Now, if this escalation goes on and nothing happens to solve the problem, we might have, in the end of the year, a much larger number of refugees, two or three times the present level.
The United Nations said last week the number of Syrian refugees has risen to an estimated 1 million people, with most concentrated in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. Syria's civil war has been ongoing for about 2 years and killed more than 70,000 people. As the war grinds on and radicalism grows, Syria's Armenian Christians are quietly leaving, some for their ancestral homeland. VOA's James Brooke caught up with some of those refugees in Yerevan.
Girls making music between classes. This could be a high school anywhere. But these girls are from Syria, having left the city of Aleppo last year for a 2-week summer vacation. They never returned home. The girls are part of a flood of 6,000 ethnic Armenians who have escaped Syria's civil war and traveled to their ancestral homeland.
Yes, 24.
While they attend high school in Yerevan, they try to keep up with friends in Syria by Skype and Facebook. 15-year-old Maria Vartanyan says of her girlfriends back home,
I can't talk with them, because when I talk with them, I will cry. I can't.
High school senior Garen Baklian says his friends from Aleppo have scattered.
A couple of my friends are in my class here in Armenia at the school, and a couple of them went to Canada. They traveled to Canada, and I know one friend who went to the States.
Sarkis Balkian is a Syrian Armenian who went to college in the United States, then moved to Armenia to help refugees.
When the conflict initially started in July, a lot of Syrian Armenians believed that it would only last for a couple of weeks. So a lot of Syrian Armenians moved to Armenia with summer clothes, and they didn't bring with them winter clothes. A lot of people didn't bring enough finances to sustain themselves in the long run.
At Yerevan's Antep restaurant, Sarkis Rizduni, a foreign currency trader, says fellow Syrian Armenians worry about the fate of Christians if Muslim radicals take power in Syria.
The Christians, they don't trust the politics of each country they live in, but they trust the Arabs, the regular Arabs, the citizens. They don't feel stable. The countries they're living in, the Middle East, it's not stable.
Driving Armenian security concerns is the collective memory of the massacres of 1.5 million Armenians by Ottoman Turks during World War I. Ever since, says Richard Girgasyan, a think tank director, Armenians have been a people primed to get up and go. After Gamal Abdel Nasser rose to power in Egypt in 1952, Armenians felt threatened by his socialist policies.
Then they left. Then it was Beirut. Then the civil war. Then it was Tehran. They left in 79 in large numbers. So there is a natural dynamic trend or change of what's called the Armenian diaspora. So the Armenian presence and position in the Middle East has never been static nor stable.
For this new generation of Armenia's diaspora, flexibility is their passport to the future. They talk of going to college in America, of going home to Aleppo, or of making their future here in Armenia. James Brook, VOA News, Yerevan.
Tunisia has been grappling with a political crisis since the assassination last month of leftist leader Chokri Belaid. Parliament is to vote on a new cabinet lineup Tuesday, but opposition politicians worry about the growing influence of militant Islam. Jamie Detmer reports from Tunis.
Protests at the killing of leftist political leader Chokri Belaid, who was gunned down outside his home on February the 6th, continue on the streets of Tunis. Some of the protesters outside the Interior Ministry are convinced that the Islamist Nahda party, which has been ruling the country in coalition with two smaller secular centre-left parties, is in some ways responsible for the slaying.
After the killed of our comrade Chokri Belaid, and just we say the assassination, the government, and we believe that the government who killed Chokri Belaid.
Nahda leaders deny any involvement in the killing, and the security services have arrested several militant Islamists, known as Salafists, in connection with the slaying, although government officials say the actual assassin is still at large. In the wake of Belaid's murder, Tunisia was plunged into its worst political crisis since the Arab Spring ouster, more than 2 years ago, of autocrat Zayn al-Abidine Ben Ali. Violent protests at the assassination brought down the government of Prime Minister Amadi Djebali. And to calm the crisis, his Nahda successor announced on Friday a new cabinet, handing over key ministries to independent figures. The cabinet reshuffle that sees Nahda yield control of the Ministries of Justice, Interior and Foreign Affairs will likely be approved by the National Assembly on Tuesday. But Nahda's failure to persuade other opposition parties to join the governing coalition highlights the political divisions that are complicating Tunisia's transition to democracy. Most opposition leaders accept that Nader itself did not have a hand in Ben Ali's slaying, but they accuse Nader of ignoring Salafist threats against the leftist leader's life, and they believe the party is fanning violence, says leftist politician Adnan Bashir.
لا الحكومة لا أعتقد أنها متورطة مباشرة في الاغتيال لكنها مسؤولة عن المناخ.
The government has no role in the assassination, but the government is responsible for the violence that is spreading all over the country. And from this point, the government is politically responsible, letting preachers in mosques and in certain religious parts preaching for violence. And in this matter, the government is really responsible.
Distrust of Nader remains high, says university professor Jalil Azeen.
Nader, even though it tried, did succeed to some extent to convince the West that it is really a moderate democratic Islamist movement, what is really going on in Tunisia today doesn't really go along with that image.
Tuesday's vote on a new cabinet lineup is unlikely to calm the fears of Nader's opponents, but the concessions at least hold out the possibility that Tunisia's political crisis may ease, if only temporarily. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Tunis.
More violence over the weekend in Egypt has some people concerned that the police cannot handle the rising challenges and that private citizens might need to form militias to maintain security. We're joined on the line by VOA Cairo correspondent Elizabeth Arrett. Elizabeth, how serious is the situation getting?
Well, Susan, the situation here has people quite concerned. I think the attack and the burning of a police club in a very wealthy neighborhood in Cairo on Saturday made clear that these disturbances can happen anywhere and that even the police can't protect their own property. On top of that, we have some police on strike and not making demands for better conditions. They want more weapons, for example. And people are worried that not just protests are getting out of control, but also just a general lawlessness. The emergence of one group of rioters known as the Black Bloc is an example of what appears just sort of anarchy for anarchy's sake.
So is there a chance that we'd see the kinds of militias we've been seeing in neighboring Libya filling in the void of a central source of order?
At this point, it doesn't seem too likely. Certainly, there are neighborhood watch groups, but not militias in the common sense. The interior minister, who heads up the police, has strongly warned against them and has also asked for the media to tone down what he sees as its vilification of the police. Now, the police have long been a source of anger in Egypt. They were seen as the enforcers of the old government's authoritarian rule, as corrupt, as brutal. And we did see the police disappear for the most part after the revolution 2 years ago, but I think the idea of militias would have a hard time gaining traction.
Why is that?
Well, the main reason is the military. Egyptians still have a fairly positive view of the army, and there's a general sense that if things go from bad to worse, then the army would step in to maintain stability. Of course, they did that after the revolution, and a lot of people got angry when they held onto power longer than they originally said they would. But we see them in control in Port Said, the flashpoint of this latest unrest, and they've been greeted there very warmly by people. It's not a great option, having to go back to the military, having to enforce order. But a lot of people seem to think that would be a better option than chaos and lawlessness.
Well, thank you very much, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Susan.
That's VOA Cairo correspondent Elizabeth Arrett. Pakistan's president is in Iran to inaugurate the construction of a new pipeline that could supply energy-starved Pakistan with natural gas. Sharon Bain reports on the project, which risks incurring international sanctions surrounding Tehran's nuclear program.
President Asif Ali Zardari and Iranian leader President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad are launching the construction of a multi-billion-dollar pipeline that would pump badly needed natural gas into Pakistan. A groundbreaking ceremony was arranged at the border between the two countries, despite serious concerns on the part of the United States. Washington has imposed a series of sanctions on Iran and those found to be dealing with Tehran because of its nuclear program. But Pakistan Foreign Ministry spokesman Muazzam Khan has made it clear Pakistan's energy needs trump concerns about possible sanctions.
We have said this repeatedly, that Pakistan being an enormously energy deficit country, it is in our national interest to have this project, and we are committed to have this project.
U.S. State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland warned last week if the deal is finalized for the proposed pipeline, it would raise serious questions under Washington's Iran Sanctions Act. She says the United States is working with Pakistan on alternative energy sources, such as a gas pipeline from Turkmenistan in Central Asia and increasing hydropower. But Mr. Zardari has insisted that the project with Iran is of immense economic importance to Pakistan and should not fall under the sanctions regime.
The world and other countries have given other nations permission to be doing business inclusive of these sanctions. So I don't see why we cannot engage the world and make sure that the world understands our point of view and Pakistan also gets a waiver for this project.
The pipeline project has been in the works since 1994, and there are questions whether the push to build a pipeline now, just weeks before the government is to face national elections, is more of a vote-winning ploy or actual policy. Pakistan has been enduring daily blackouts and chronic energy shortages affecting businesses and homes for several years. Pakistan officials have said the pipeline could come online by the end of 2014. Rashid Mahmood, who has been waiting in line for compressed natural gas for his car, welcomes the deal with Iran.
I am very happy and our puri nation is very happy for this agreement which is signed by President Zardari. It is the one of the most important and very beneficial agreement last 5 years.
Even if the country forges ahead with the deal, it is not clear how Pakistan will pay for the construction of the 780-kilometer pipeline from its western border with Iran, or how it will ensure the safety of the line that would cross volatile Balochistan province. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Islamabad.
Turks form the largest minority group in Germany, but traditional ways of thinking have made it hard for some men to integrate into society. As Michael Scaturo reports from Berlin, a support group geared toward Turkish men is helping them discuss their problems.
Kazim Erdogan's office sits in a rough but slowly gentrifying corner of Berlin. By day, the 60-year-old native of Turkey works for the city's child welfare office. In his free time, he runs what he says is Europe's first support group for immigrant men.
Das Projekt wurde 2007 gegründet, zuerst nur für türkische Männer. Und wir haben nur mit zwei Männern begonnen, aber jetzt sind es schon über 80 Männer.
Erdogan says he began holding support groups back in 2007. At first, just two men attended, but today, more than 80 men take part. Erdogan has since become an advocate of bringing together immigrant men to help one another.
Belirli bir yaştan sonra bazı tanıdıklarımız var, 40'a yakın. 40'a yakın.
O zamana kadar işlem yaptırmamışsa eğer.
The group meets every Monday and speaks in Turkish because few of the men speak German fluently. On any given night, Kazim Erdogan's role might shift from moderator to therapist. The discussion topics vary widely, from helping kids get better grades in school to honor killings or arranged marriages.
Ich kenne einen Mann auch. Er hat vier Kinder, fast er auch jede Frau Gewalt gemacht. Nur Körperverletzung und sowas. Und er hat halbes Jahr nicht mit deiner Familie Kontakt gehabt. Er kommt auch vielleicht heute.
Murat Tash attended a recent meeting with his German girlfriend, Yana. Tash is 40 years old and comes from eastern Anatolia. He's one of Kazim Erdogan's most active members, and he's helped him organize anti-domestic violence marches in the past. Tash says he sometimes brings Turkish work colleagues to the meetings. One such man was a father of four who had been beating his wife. At first, the man met privately with Kazim Erdogan, but eventually he and his wife began coming to meetings together. Tash says that after a few months, the abusive husband tearfully apologized to the wife in front of the other men. Turkey's Consul General in Berlin, Bashar Sen, met with the group. Sen says the group fills a gap in social services.
The group is a product of their 40 years experiences in Germany. This is more or less a circle, men against violence, yes.
Until Erdogan started the group, immigrant Turkish men often felt isolated and struggled with their problems by themselves. And this sometimes led to domestic violence. Kazim Erdogan admits that his method is not always perfect. but he says that by teaching Turkish men and boys that it's okay to talk about their problems, he's helping change a culture of silence in immigrant communities. Michael Scaturo for VOA News in Berlin.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.